Okay, ladies and gentlemen, time now for business as usual. We are back to the history of the English language, and today we're going to delve into the most ancient parts of the history of the language. So last time we learned that English sprang out of nowhere in 449 AD, maybe not exactly out of nowhere, but at least it arose and was used, and the Anglo-Saxons brought it to the British Isles. But that's not the start of the story. It would be nice if that were the start of the story, but to understand what really happens with English, to get inside the skin of English, we have to go back even further than that. And that's what we're going to do today. And part of today will be to introduce the very basic principles of historical linguistics to you, because these principles are really quite important, not just in linguistics, in historical linguistics of English, but also for language families more generally across the world. The kind of questions that we touch on today we'll be sticking with throughout the course. So this isn't just sort of linguistic archaeology for archaeology's sake. This will actually tell us something quite important about how languages change in general. So we're going to talk about linguistic family trees and linguistic relatedness, moving on to linguistic reconstruction, that is, how do we figure out more about languages that we don't have any direct records of. Then we're going to talk about long-term grammatical change, how the grammatical systems of languages change over time, with particular reference to English. And then we're going to take a brief detour to talk about some of the sources of evidence that we do have and where that evidence comes in. Because in general, just as any historical discipline, you should be skeptical. You should be skeptical of any source. You should always be thinking, when you see a claim, when you see a generalization, what is this based on? Where is the material that this comes from? And that's what we're going to talk about towards the end. And then finally, we're going to take a quick look at possibilities for going even further back in time. But first, here's a quick reminder of the tutorials. So your tutorials are either today or on Friday. The first ones begin. They're in the evening, so Monday at 5, Monday at 6:45, and Friday then at 8:15. You don't need to sign up for these tutorials, just show up, and if there is an imbalance, we will sort it out later on. Your tutors are Thomas and Christoph, who are down here at the front, and they will be happy to provide their wisdom to you. Okay. So first of all, family trees and relatedness. We talk about languages as if they've got families, but that's not a particularly obvious or necessary thing to do if we put languages into family trees. So here, for instance, we've got the Indo-European family. This is the family that English belongs to, uncontroversially. So here you can see that we've got a language here at the top. Oops, sorry, a language here at the top, Proto-Indo-European. The Proto, we'll come across this again and again today. Proto means we don't have any direct records of it. This is a hypothesized language. We have very good reasons for hypothesizing that this exact language must have existed, and I'll come on to them in due course. But for now, this is the Indo-European family, and the mother language is called Proto-Indo-European. And this family is something that you probably many of the languages here will be familiar to you, even if some of these terms aren't necessarily. We've got Albanian, we've got Armenian over here, and within Indo-Iranian, we have languages like Sanskrit and its present-day descendants, Persian. So this is a big family. Italic. Italic is not something that you just do to fonts in Word documents. It's also a language family, and it contains the Romance languages, among others. Celtic languages are important in the history of English, and we're going to talk a little bit more about them throughout the course. Balto-Slavic, these are languages like Russian, Russian, Polish, Bulgarian, but also the Baltic languages, languages like Lithuanian. And so these are all branches of the Indo-European family. When we zoom in a bit, the only one I've given you details of is Germanic. And here you can see that Germanic has three branches. The North Germanic branch, that's basically the Scandinavian languages, and so Icelandic, Danish, Norwegian, Swedish. East Germanic is the Gothic language, which we no longer have any records of. We do have records of it, but we no longer have any speakers of it. That's the crucial thing. The speakers either died out or switched to other languages. And then we've got the West Germanic languages, which contain a lot of languages that will be familiar to people in the room. So, for instance, German comes in here, Dutch comes in here, Frisian comes in here, and English, both old and modern, at least under normal assumptions. So that's the Indo-European family. Already this is begging the question, because I've said we talk about languages as if they've got families, but what does it mean for a language to have a family? We know people have families, but people have families in very particular ways, right? People get married to other people, there are children involved, usually two parents, at least at some stage. Languages, we don't see that here, right? One mother, no father. You know, this is a non-prototypical family, though there are a lot of families like this. And so this languages obviously don't work the same way as people. Languages are not the same as people. What does it mean to talk about them in trees in this way? So that is something that we're going to be touching on in the first part of today's lecture. Just a little bit more context first on the Indo-Europeans. So the Indo-Europeans were... There was a language. We don't have any records of it, but we know it must have existed. We know that it spread at some point in prehistory. Exactly how and when it spread is a matter of some dispute. So up here we've got Britain, and there are two big hypotheses about where exactly Indo-European came from. The one which has probably slightly more support in the research community in general, is the steppe hypothesis. So this is associated with Gumbutas' work, and it's been supported very robustly in a recent work by David Anthony, which is given in the references, which you can find online. This associates the Indo-European language with a culture called the Yamna culture in the Russian steppes. So this is north of the Caspian Sea, and in a time period of somewhere around 4,500 to 2,500 BC. We necessarily have to be very approximate about this. And there have been recent genetic studies that have given some support to this view. On the other hand, we've got the Anatolian hypothesis, which is associated with the archaeologist Colin Renfrew. And this says that the Indo-European languages originated in Asia Minor. And Asia Minor, aka Turkey, Now, the speakers, most people in this area are not speakers of Indo-European, but they would have been at the time, according to this hypothesis. And this spread, again, it spread out via Greece. It was associated with the spread of modern farming methods, modern agriculture. So these two hypotheses, and this hypothesis has some support from recent computational approaches to historical linguistics, among other things, as well as some archaeological and historical support. And it could be, it's worth saying, note that the time scale here is quite different. This is a much earlier origin. Right? Everyone who proposes this hypothesis thinks that these people were there much earlier. So it could be that there is some way of actually reconciling these two hypotheses. Maybe this arrow here is pretty important. But these are all issues that go well beyond the scope of this course. I just wanted to let you know where roughly the Indo-Europeans came from. Because although we don't know exactly whether they came from here or here, we can be pretty confident that they didn't come from over there or up here, Iceland. Much as the Icelanders like to think that their language is the oldest and the most original, In that respect, definitely not. Okay, so now the question is, what does a tree like this actually mean? How is it constructed? I told you to be skeptical. You shouldn't just believe something like this at face value. When you get given a tree like this, you need to question it. You need to question the assumptions that are used in building it. The toolkit that people use for building trees like this is called the comparative method. Now, the comparative method in historical linguistics is not really a very well-defined entity, but it is something that works robustly. So historical linguists usually go by the maxim, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. What we do with the comparative method is to establish linguistic relatedness and to carry out reconstruction. And these are also the two main steps. The first one, which I'll talk about in some depth, involves establishing correspondences. This is what's crucial. The notion of systematic correspondences is crucial to the linguistic comparative method. Obviously, when I talk about relatedness, I talk about it in exactly the same sense as I would talk about it with people. So two languages are related if one of them is descended from the other, or if both descended from a common source. So that's not controversial, but the basic idea in languages is that if they share systematic sound correspondences, they have to be related. And now, I will have to define for you what I mean by systematic sound correspondences. And to do that, it's important to talk about what they're not. So, in different languages, we find words that are similar to one another. And words can sound similar to each other for various reasons. I've given three of them here on the slide. So language contact is a very important cause of similarity. This falls under the heading of language external. Remember the sort of overarching theme of internal versus external. This is the prototypical external cause of language change. So English has a word beef. The word beef is borrowed from French, specifically borrowed from Anglo-Norman. It's borrowed from Anglo-Norman for a reason. We can simplify right now and say that it's just due to the prestige of that language earlier in the history of English, after the Norman conquest. English borrows many, many words. English borrows words like kamikaze. English borrows words like alcohol. Arabic word alcohol. It borrows words from all over the place, and this is something that as we saw last time, English is very notorious for. So this is one reason why words might sound similar, right? English and French are related, but that's not the reason that English beef and French boeuf sound the same. The reason is much more straightforward, namely that English took this word from French. They thought, we'll have this. Now, again, something to be skeptical about, this word borrowing. Right? We talk about borrowing a word, but it's not clear that borrowing is really the best notion to use in terms of words. Because normally when you borrow something, let's say you borrow a library book, at some point you probably want to give it back, otherwise you'll get a huge fine. Okay? But if you borrow a word, it's not as if English is going to give this word back to French at some point in the future, right? So borrowing is a very imperfect metaphor in the linguistic context. It's more like, language contact is more like if you rip a DVD, right? You've got a DVD with a movie on it, you make a copy of it on your computer. You don't ever need to give it back to anyone, right? And language contact is like that. There's another reason that languages can have similar words. One of them there are two other reasons at least, three, I'll comment again, coincidence. So two languages can have the same word or a similar word for absolutely no reason. So here we've got two examples from Hawaiian and ancient Greek. Hawaiian, the word for honey is meli. Ancient Greek, the word for honey is also meli. This is very striking, okay? In ancient Greek, the word for pillar is kion. In Hawaiian, it's kia. And again, this is a striking similarity. But why does this hold? Why is this true? Well, we don't want to say that it's because Hawaiian and ancient Greek are related, right? That doesn't make any sense, right? They're thousands of years apart. They're on the other side of the world from one another. There's no way that Hawaiian and ancient Greek can be related to one another. Rather, it's sometimes simply the case that languages come up with the same word for the same thing. And when you think about it, that's not actually that unusual. How many sounds are there in the English language? How many sounds are there in any language? And how many ways of combining them into words actually are there? Ultimately, there's a finite number. And when you think about it that way, at least a finite number of combining three-segment words, let's say, or four-segment words. So sooner or later, two words are going to completely by chance have the same pronunciation in two different languages. So this is striking, but it's coincidence, and we see this across the world's languages. And then finally, another reason that languages can have the same sounding words is because of onomatopoeia. So this magnificent bird on the side here makes a sound that's something like okay. But how do we render that in language? Languages, it turns out, do this in similar ways. In English, for instance, the sound that this guy makes is called cock-a-doodle-doo. Right? I don't think there's much of a doodle or a do in there, personally, but that's just what we say. In Lingala, it's kokoliko. In Finnish, it's kukkukiku. And in German, I hear it's kikeriki. I don't know where the stress goes on that. But what do these words have in common? They've all got k's in them. Right? They are different, and they're different in ways that actually tell us something about the phonologies of these languages. But what's important for the moment is that they all have k's in them, and that's not an accident. That's because this bird sounds like it's making a k. That's fine. Right? There aren't any languages, or at least not that I know of. Tell me if you find a counterexample, but my hypothesis is that there are no languages where this guy goes peng, peng, peng. Right? That's not the noise that this thing makes. So those are three reasons that words can be similar that have nothing to do with relatedness. These are completely tangential to the issue of relatedness. But when we see real relatedness, we see something else. We see something very striking. Here, you can see words house, mouse, louse, out, and brown. And in my variety of English, these all have an ow diphthong in them. Now, if you look at other languages, they have different sounds. So, for instance, Dutch has an ö sound here. German au, it's a bit lower, perhaps. Danish, I'm not even going to try and do that one. Swedish has a u. And what's really striking, and as you can see from the color coding, is that these words don't just have similar sounds. Rather, you can set up systematic equalities between these languages. So wherever you get this ow in English, you get an ö. It's not just in specific words. This holds for whole sets of words to a first approximation, all words. And this is really quite quite incredible. Now, the important thing about this is that something like this is not likely to arise through coincidence. Right? Two words may be unlikely, but they may sound the same. Similarly, borrowing, unless one of these languages has borrowed all of its basic words from another one, these are not going to be the same because of borrowing. And are they going to be the same because of onomatopoeia? Well, no, of course not. Right? Out. What is the onomatopoeia of out? What is it supposed to sound like? It's a grammatical word. It doesn't have one. So we've got similarities here that go way beyond individual words sounding the same. We've got very systematic correspondences. And that is what I mean when I talk about these systematic sound correspondences. And this is the key smoking gun that tells us that what we're dealing with is linguistic relatedness between languages. The question then is, why do we find these correspondences? Why is it the case that we find words, that we find sounds that map systematically onto other sounds across a whole set of lexical items? And the answer is, that sound change is regular. And the regularity of sound change is just about the most important thing I'm going to tell you probably today, probably even on the entire course. So this notion, basically what I'm saying is it isn't words that change. When it comes to pronunciation, words don't change. What changes is sounds. And when a sound changes, it doesn't matter what words it's in, all of the words that are, have that sound in it, in the right position, will be affected. And that, so regardless of the word or the morpheme. And in fact, when we look at this table, we can see, we can actually diagnose what happened. What we actually can figure out, based on the records that we have, is that the Swedish is actually the oldest in this instance. So there would have been a mother language, which we can call Proto-Germanic, right, the Germanic mother language, Proto-Germanic, which all of these are descended from, and it would have had words that were a bit like the Swedish in this regard. Ooh, okay? And what happened, we can see this in the German written records, in the early New High German period, ooh changed into au. Now, again, that wasn't specific words, that was the sound changing, and all of the words which contained a long ooh became au. So here we've got house, mouse, louse, house, mouse, louse, aus, and braun. And in English, a similar change took place. So here we've got the similar sounds for exactly the same reason. A sound change happened that affected all of the words, that affected this sound. And in Old English, which we're going to talk about in detail next week, we don't see this au, instead we see an u as in Swedish. Same in Old High German. Right. This is striking. By the way, just while I remember, there is an exercise that goes with today's lecture that I'd like you to have a go at before the tutorial, if you can. It's 1-4 in the textbook. This is the textbook. The relevant exercises you can find online because I've just uploaded this last night. So you can have a look and try and have a go at that before the lecture. Before the tutorial. I've been told that some of you are having trouble accessing this book. Hopefully help is on its way. But bits of it will be made available for you to read. Right, so we've talked about the regularity of sound change. Specifically, this change in German happened between the 12th and the 14th centuries. It happened quite early, and then it stopped happening. So this is an important principle. Sound changes are temporal contingencies. They only happen at a given time in a given place. Now, some sound changes will affect sounds only in certain sound environments. So here we've got another systematic correspondence. Here we've got a systematic correspondence between a T and a T in German. And this correspondence between T and T is only held at the beginning of words. So here we've got examples. So English tide corresponds to German Zeit. These are basically the same word, it's just that there's been a semantic change, a meaning change. Two and zwei, toe and zier, tin and zin, two and zu. These are related words, and again, they're systematically related. There are systematic correspondences, but here, the relevant sound change only affects the beginning of words. So it's word initial, T, that changes to T in the case of German. That conditioned nature of sound change can also be quite important sometimes. It's not always the case that all words are affected by a sound change, but all words where the relevant sound change environment is found. Here, the sound change environment is word initial. Okay, so As I've said, this is the smoking gun, because systematic sound correspondences of this kind only emerge through regular sound change within a language. They don't emerge through borrowing, chance, or onomatopoeia. That's the important thing. I mean, they could emerge through borrowing, chance, or onomatopoeia, but the likelihood of that happening is so low that we can safely rule it out in almost all of these cases. Certainly in these cases I've just showed you, we can rule it out with certainty. So if two languages exhibit systematic sound correspondences like this, we know that they must be related. So there is a crucial relationship between language families and the regularity of sound change. Right, so that's relatedness. Hopefully now you understand where these trees come from. When you get a tree like the Indo-European one, what it means for languages to be related. It means that they share systematic sound correspondences. And the more systematic sound correspondences languages share, the more closely related they are said to be. So, for instance, Germanic, we'll come back to soon, the Germanic languages share more changes with each other than they do with, let's say, Armenian or Persian or French. And that is how, that's why we put them into a group together. But now we're going to talk about this process of going backwards, because I've said already that Proto-Germanic, this ancestor language of the Germanic languages, had an U, for instance, in words like Hus, house. And how do we know that? What methods can we use? I've said in that case, we can be pretty confident because the actual texts show us the change happening in languages like English and German. So that's fine. But what happens when we don't have written records? What happens when we want to go further back than the written records that we have? And this is often the case because there is no linguistic principle that determines whether a particular people or a particular culture will write something down. That is a socio-political decision. In some languages, there is a strong written tradition. In some languages, some very thriving languages, there is no written tradition. And that has much more to do with politics and sociology than it does with anything in their language structure. And when we go to the Germanic languages, we find that no one was writing anything down at all before about 200 AD. But we know that they must have existed before then. They didn't spring from nowhere. So what do we do if we want to figure out what languages like Proto-Germanic or Proto-Indo-European looked like? That's what linguistic reconstruction is for. So, as I've said, we want to get to Proto-Indo-European. We want to follow this branch up to the very top. We know that it must have existed. We have some idea of who was speaking it and where they were speaking it, but we don't have any records. And that could be because the people weren't writing anything down, or it could be because if they were writing anything down, it hasn't survived. Obviously, writings are fragile things. Paper deteriorates. Even physical objects, when people carve things into them, they can go missing. They can sink to the bottom of the sea. Someone can burn them. People like to burn things. So what do we do? We have to reconstruct, and this is possible. So here we've got a little fable. This is the fable of the sheep and the horses. August Schleicher, a 19th century German linguist, was actually confident enough that he knew what Proto-Indo-European looked like that he wrote a little story in it. So here's the story. It's a rather silly story. So here's the English translation. It's about sheep and some horses, and they have a little conversation with each other. It's basically just banter. So you've got the sheep delivers a sick burn to the horses, and the horses respond, and the sheep loses the verbal exchange and then runs away. So this is Schleicher's reconstruction. And if you look this up, Schleicher's Fable, it's called, you'll see lots of different versions of this. Now, it's not based on anything. It's just a story that he made up. And it's interesting that he chose particular words to do so. So in particular, these words, there's nothing enormously unusual in this story, right? There are lots of very basic words, and that is what we'd expect because these are the words that we can most confidently reconstruct. We can be the most sure about these words. What we do see is that there are many words in here that are related to farming. Obviously, the name of the agriculture. We've got the sheep, we've got the horses, we've got wool, we've got a wagon, right? And this also, this is probably, especially if the Anatolian hypothesis is on the right track, or if the spread of Indo-European has something to do with the spread of farming, this also may be no accident. But farming is also something that's very basic to the societies of the first millennium AD and to societies today. So there's another reason that we might get these words. This is Schleicher's version of the fable. As people have improved their knowledge of what this language looks like, they have changed the way that this is written. So now, for instance, you can see in here there are a lot of A's, right? Really a lot of A's. That is because Schleicher thought that Indo-European looked a lot like Sanskrit, basically. He was very convinced that Indo-European was very close to Sanskrit in that regard. Most linguists nowadays don't think so. So the details of this are disputed. But the idea that you can actually reconstruct well enough to write something like this is mostly fairly uncontroversial, interestingly enough. When we reconstruct, what we reconstruct is called a protoform, and it's marked with an asterisk. So let's take a concrete example now. Let's take a very simple example with only a few words in it. In Italian and Spanish and Portuguese, we've got words for goat and for top or head. And in Italian, these words have a p in the middle. So capra and capo. In Spanish, they've got a b, which can also be fricated. But say it's a b for now, cabra and cabo. And same in Portuguese. So we've got a p, we've got a systematic correspondence here. I could give you more words. I've only given you two to keep it simple. We've got a systematic correspondence here. We know that these three languages are related for other reasons. So what do we reconstruct? So what can we do here? What are our options? If we want to figure out what the word for goat was in the mother language, the language that is the ancestor of all of these three, well, we can say that it had a p in the middle, we could say that it had a b in the middle, or we could say that it had something completely different in the middle. For simplicity, let's assume that the language was as close as possible to its descendants, and so it must be either a p or a b. And then we want to know which one. That's the question that we're interested in now. What does the ancestor language, what would the ancestor language have shown? And the way we can get a handle on this question is that we know that some sound changes are more common than others. Some kinds of change happen with greater frequency across the world's languages. Sound change is now well enough studied that we can make this kind of generalization very robustly. So we can see here, per often changes into ber when it's between two vowels, but not vice versa. There are articulatory reasons for that. It's to do with voicing. I won't go into the details of that. We just know that p usually changes into b between vowels, but the opposite change is much, much less likely to occur. As a result, we can make what we can consider an educated guess. One change has taken place. It's a common change, and p has turned into b in the ancestor of Spanish and Portuguese, or even individually in those two languages. And what's great about this example is that we can check our reconstruction. We can check whether our method has worked or not. And in this case, our method does work because we have Latin, which, to a first approximation, is the ancestor of these three languages. It's not quite that simple, but to a first approximation, it's true. And in Latin, we find this word, capra and caput, meaning top, with a p. So we've made an educated guess, and here our educated guess turns out to be right. Now, we won't always be as lucky as we are in this case. So here, remember, we're dealing with a family where the ancestor language is actually known. We have lots of records of Latin. In the case of Germanic, we're not that lucky. We don't have records in the same way. We don't have records of Proto-Germanic. But we know that the methods that we use for reconstructing it are sound, because when we apply them to cases where we do have an ancestor language attested, it gives the right results. Do you see the reasoning there? Okay. So, one more thing that it's worth saying about this comparative method of reconstruction. So far, all of the examples that we've taken have been from Indo-European languages. It's been from the Indo-European family. And there's a nice book about Indo-European by James Claxon that you can get. Again, it's in the references for this lecture. But this method isn't just applied to Indo-European. It was developed largely in the context of Indo-European, but in the 19th and 20th centuries, the comparative method has been very widely applied to all of the languages of the world, and has yielded spectacular results. So whenever people talk about language families, language classifications now, this is what they mean. Broadly speaking, they use the set of tools we've just been talking about. They use these tools for establishing relatedness, and to a lesser extent, doing reconstruction. Obviously, reconstruction is interesting for historical linguists because it allows you to know more about pathways of change cross-linguistically, but it's also interesting in its own right, much as archaeology is interesting in its own right and history is interesting in its own right. We can be interested in reconstruction because it allows us to go further back in time. We can figure out what a prehistoric or pre-written record society would have looked like, or in this case, what they would have sounded like. All right, when it comes to Germanic, we've got three major innovations. First of all, there's a stress shift. This is a very simple one, actually. In the early Germanic languages, and it's still the case in many Germanic languages, the stress goes on the first syllable of a word. So the beginning of the word is stressed. This isn't the case in other branches of Indo-European, and we don't reconstruct it as being the case for Proto-Indo-European either. So in Proto-Indo-European, the stress could go all over the place, depending on the word. In Germanic, the stress is on the first syllable. That's a strong property of Germanic that sets it apart from the other languages. So that's one of the reasons, one of the three main reasons that we posit a Germanic subgroup. The second one is the dental preterite, and the third one is Grimm's Law. And I'm going to talk about those two things because they're both good examples of other things that are relevant to the course. And in fact, I'm going to talk about them in the opposite order. So we'll start with Grimm's Law. Here is Grimm himself, looking earnest, and what Grimm found was that there were sound changes that happened in all of the Germanic languages. Well, let's go back a step. He found that there were correspondences. He found that there are correspondences between certain sounds in Germanic languages and certain other sounds in non-Germanic Indo-European languages. So, for instance, where other Indo-European languages have a p, Germanic languages will have a f, and so on. There are nine of them, in fact, in this context. As you can see, these are not coincidentally related sounds. A bit of basic phonetics will tell you these are all the voiced stops. These are all the voiceless stops. These are all the voiced stops. These are actually voiced aspirated stops, but they're not completely arbitrary sets of sounds. This change, he posited that there must have been a change in the Germanic languages which changed p's into f's, t's into th's, k's into ch's, and so on and so forth. And this has been called Grimm's Law, or the first consonant shift. And again, it's one of the most distinguishing characteristics of Germanic. So let's look at this in a little bit more detail. Here we've got a table. We've got non-Germanic languages along this side. We've got Germanic languages along this side. The thing to concentrate on here is the ters in the non-Germanic languages versus the thers in the Germanic languages. So in all of the non-Germanic languages, we've got a t here in these words. So for instance, the word for a brother in Sanskrit is something like bratar with a t, and frater in ancient Greek. Old Church Slavonic, bratru. In all of these places, there's a t. In the middle of the word has a t in it. Germanic has a th. So this is the kind of evidence for Grimm's law that we need. Grimm was one of a few people working at the same time who discovered broadly the same thing. There's a Danish scholar, Rasmus Rask, who chronologically was probably slightly before Grimm in discovering the same set of correspondences. So this is a really striking set of correspondences. This is just examples involving per and th, but you can see it meets all of the characteristics that we talked about earlier for a set of systematic correspondences. And when that happens, we can see that what we think is going on is a regular sound change. Now, on all of these issues, if you're interested in reading more, and Grimm's law is more complicated than what I've just presented, you can have a look at Campbell 2013 or other editions of Lyle Campbell's Introduction to Historical Linguistics, which gives you more information on general historical linguistics and the background to comparative historical linguistics and how it works in a very non-language family specific sense. But we're going to focus in on Germanic for a bit for the rest of this course. But obviously it's important when you're looking at how English changes in particular to understand how languages change in general, because English is a language. All right, so far we've only talked about sounds, and sound change is really interesting, but we want to talk about other things too. So what about grammatical change? What about the structural makeup of sentences? Well, that changes too, and actually this, across the Indo-European languages, changes in ways that can be parallel. But this is the remaining feature of Germanic that sets Germanic apart from the other Indo-European languages, the dental preterite. Right? It's called dental because it's formed with a dental sound, so d, t, s, or th, and preterite simply means past tense, finite form of the past tense. So in English, we've got play, a non-finite infinitive form, and played, the past form. German, spielen, spielte, with a t. Danish, leh, and leh, or something like that. I told you Danish doesn't do very well on consonants. But there is a d in there somewhere, at least historically. All of the Germanic languages have a simple past tense that is formed using this d or t or s or th. And none of the other Indo-European languages do. So this again defines Indo-European as a family. Defines Germanic as a subgroup, a subfamily. So the probable origin of this form, and this is also debated, but the probable origin is a verb plus a form of to do. So here we've got nazian, meaning to save. And this is from Gothic. Remember the Gothic language, which has died out. This is one of the earliest attested Germanic languages. It's the earliest Germanic language for which we have extensive written records. And in Gothic, we find forms like this, nazi dedun, which looks like it's formed from a form of this, so to save, and then a form of the verb to do. And we have this kind of form in modern English too, so you can say things like, he did save, with a non-finite form of save, and a finite form of do. And if these two words kind of got glued together, magically sort of stuck together as two separate words becoming a single word, then we can see how this dental preterite might have developed. In fact, this is a process that we quite often see in language change. There's nothing magical about it. It has a horrible name, a horrible long name, grammaticalization. Historical linguists like long words that end in -ization. I will try and spare you most of them, but if you really want to read about pragmaticalization and constructionalization, then please be my guest. But we often see this process in language change. We see more lexical words, that is, words with contentful lexical semantics, becoming more grammatical words. We see open class words like nouns and verbs becoming closed class words like prepositions and auxiliaries. So this is something that we see quite often in language change, and it also correlates with words losing their autonomous wordhood. So in a way, words get kind of ground down. They become smaller words, they become bleached, they have less independent conceptual meaning, but they also lose their form. So an independent word will become a clitic, and then an affix. A clitic is a word that is phonologically dependent. So for instance, some people have said that nt in English, in forms like didn't and wouldn't, is a clitic. You can't have nt on its own. And then affix, you should all know. So these are the tendencies. This trajectory, lexical to grammatical, or free word to clitic to affix, these are tendencies that we see across the world's languages, not only in Germanic, not only in Indo-European. And what's important here is that the opposite changes are less likely to occur. So it's rarer to see a grammatical item turning into a full-fledged lexical item than it is to see the other way around. But if we assume that this dental preterite comes from a form of the verb to do, like, so this form originally meant something like save plus did, and then the English form played would come from play did, and that somehow got kind of mashed together and compressed and just turned into played. That's a plausible origin story for this dental preterite, which sets Germanic apart from all of the other Indo-European languages. Are there any questions at this point? All right, now we can have some Sanskrit, because Sanskrit is great. Sanskrit has a bunch of different cases. You're probably all familiar with case systems because you'll at least have come into contact with German, which has a fairly robust one. But Sanskrit is even further along this line. It has a very impressive case system. It has 8 different cases. So some of these you will probably recognize: nominative, accusative. These are subject and direct object cases, basically. Dative, we've got a genitive. Those are cases that are familiar from modern German, but we've also got cases that the German doesn't have, like an instrumental. Now, the instrumental is fun. The instrumental is basically, this is the instrument with which the action takes place. So if you say something like, I killed the man with a sword, the sword will go into the instrumental case. And this is something that in, for instance, Old English texts, you see. And Old English actually maintains an instrumental case. We also have a locative case for the place in which action happens. We've got an ablative case for the source of action. And we've got a vocative for a person being addressed. So this is a language with a very, very robust case system. So if you want to see an example of the locative here, we've got one, Rama, forest, with a locative case ending, lives. So basically, Rama lives forest. You don't need to say in the forest because the locative case ending does that for you, right? It tells you that you're dealing with in the forest because that's what the locative means. So this is a language where the form of words can differ quite extensively according to what the case is. You don't need to understand this system in detail, but what you can see, the crucial generalization that I want you to take away from this is there are a whole load of endings on these words, different ones, right? That's the point. Also, on verbs, you see a whole load of different endings, and the endings depend on the person and number of the subject, largely. So Sanskrit, which, as I've said before, some scholars like Schleicher have taken to be very, very close to Proto-Indo-European, is an example of an archaic Indo-European language. What we see in its modern descendants is that these endings fall off, basically. They grind down, they fall off, they are eroded, to borrow a geological metaphor. And so then you have Hindi or Urdu, its modern descendants, where you get forms where the case endings are lost. So here, for instance, we've got an example. He goes from the city to the forest. And here you've lost any case endings on words like city and forest. So you might expect to see an ablative or a locative in Sanskrit. We don't see that. What we see instead is that other words pop up, prepositions. We see a from preposition. We see a to preposition. And we also see other words like to be. We see he, the pronoun he. These words also you typically wouldn't see in Sanskrit. So here's the Sanskrit example. Only three words. Ablative, accusative, and a verb. We don't need the prepositions because the prepositions, what their meaning is already contained within the nouns because they're case marked. We don't need the we don't particularly need the pronoun which is war in Hindi or Urdu because that's already implied by the verb ending t here. So what we can see is that we lose, in the transition between Sanskrit and Urdu, we lose endings and we gain independent words. And so this is not just a trajectory that we see in Sanskrit in the history of the Indo-Iranian languages, it's also something that we see in the history of Germanic. So in Germanic too, the words get much simpler over time. We lose endings, especially in English. And that ties in, of course, to one of our big themes, which is synthetic versus analytic. This is a perfect example of a language becoming analytic where it used to be synthetic. This happens in Romance, it happens in Germanic, it happens all across Indo-European. Except that what we can say is that the earliest Germanic that we have, so even a language like Gothic, is already less synthetic than Sanskrit. A language like Old English, which we're going to talk about next week, is less synthetic than Sanskrit. But the direction of change is the same. We're going from synthetic to analytic here. Okay. So now we're going to gradually come back round to the history of English and the history of the Germanic languages, more concretely, by talking about the early evidence. Here is a piece of the early evidence. Doesn't come out too clearly here, but this is a horn. This is the golden horn of Galahus. So we can talk about the earliest written evidence. As I've said, the earliest written evidence in Germanic is reasonably late. What about written evidence in general? Well, as I've also said, written evidence doesn't always survive. People write things down. It has to stand the test of time. It's items, for an item to last 7,000 years or more, it has to be very durable. So when we go back to the earliest human writing, it's only something like 7,000 years ago. That's about as far back as we can go in terms of actual writing systems that we can decipher. The very earliest one, this Henan Chinese writing system, is probably not even a writing system at all. But we get the Vinca inscriptions, which are in southern Europe, and they're from about 7,000 years ago. And languages that are more robustly attested, we have, for instance, Egyptian, which starts off 5,300 years ago, and then Mesopotamian cuneiform from 5,100 years ago. This is an example of a cuneiform, actually pre-cuneiform tablets. It's called cuneiform because it's a cuneiform means wedge-shaped, and these symbols are wedge-shaped. You can see the reason these things have survived is because they weren't written on paper or anything like it. You used a wedge and you went wedge, and that made your tablets that looked like this. And those things are a lot more robust. So that's why they survived. This is actually a bill of sale. I think they're using it to sell slaves or something like that. They were quite keen on that. So these are the earliest writing systems that we have, and none of them are Germanic. Right? In general, writing systems can be one of three types, and sometimes there are mishmashes of these types. So writing systems can be logographic, where a symbol represents a whole word. They can be syllabic, where a symbol represents a syllable. Or they can be alphabetic, where a symbol represents a single segment or a single sound. The earliest writing systems, the Egyptian hieroglyphs, for instance, if we take them, these are some of the more boring ones. Most of the time when people talk about hieroglyphs, they talk about a cat or a bird or someone doing this or something like that. These are boring ones. The basket and the sun. Sometimes people compare Egyptian hieroglyphs to emojis. They say these are just a sort of symbolic system of communication. That doesn't really work very well, because the thing about these is they're not just symbols for things. So for instance, Neb, this one, which is a basket, also represents the quantifier every. Now, you can't draw a picture of the word every, right? Or at least you could try. I would like to see the results, actually. Maybe I'll run a competition for the best picture of the word every. But every doesn't refer. It doesn't have a concrete referential meaning. But the word in ancient Egyptian was pronounced neb, the same as the word for basket. And as a result, this symbol, the basket symbol, was used for the word neb also when it meant every. You see how that works? You've got a symbol that stands for one thing. You've got the value of the symbol is gradually transferred from the value of the referent, the actual thing, to the value of the sounds that make up the word for that referent, the form. So that's why you get this transition. Similarly, you get this shift where this word ra means sun, and it can also stand for the word hru, meaning day, because every day the sun comes up. There's a kind of metaphorical shift. So this system is not purely logographic. In fact, it's difficult to imagine a completely and purely logographic system. Sometimes people say that Chinese is a logographic system. It's not. Chinese is actually syllabic in this sense, or at least mostly. It's, again, like Egyptian, it's some combination of the two. But this is the kind of writing systems that we get. These early ones tend to be on the logographic syllabic end of things, and then as we move on to more recent ones, we get quite a lot of alphabetic systems. Now, writing systems, unquestionably, I should also say, were developed multiple times. So there wasn't originally one writing system that came with the original humans. Right. Writing systems were probably developed separately. They must have been developed separately in different places around the world, independently by different humans, because writing is much, much younger than language. That also is an important thing to remember. In the present day, we often think of writing as being primary. We often think of writing as being the form that language ought to take. But really, language is a very young thing. It's a kind of imposter on the linguistic scene when it comes to writing is very young. I'm going to skip this slide because it's so misleading as to be almost completely useless. I'll get a fixed version of this. This is not what the runic alphabet looked like. This is Arabic or this is not runic. Anyway, these are supposed to be runes. Runes are beautiful. Runes are a thing of real wonder. So runes are great because you can draw them on chalkboards really easily. If you don't break your chalk. So that's a thorn. Thorn is a rune. There are various of these runes. You get a runic R, which looks broadly like that. The great thing about runes is that you can draw them in straight lines, which makes your life as a chalk person much, much easier. And that's not an accident. It's not an accident because the runes were designed to be carved. And that is the main reason they have survived, once again. They survive as part of physical objects that someone has carved into. In fact, the word write, the modern English word to write, as in to write an essay, written language, originally meant to carve. So that's where writing comes from, at least in the Germanic context. That's where runes come from. I'm going to try and show you some actual runes now. Here you go. Here's the golden horn of Galahus. This is the horn I mentioned earlier on. These horns had a rather checkered history. They got discovered in Denmark in 1639 and 1734. They're much, much older. They're a very, very early record of Germanic carving. The annoying thing about the golden horns of Galahus was that they happened to be made of gold. And because they were made of gold, people kept nicking them and then melting them. Or at least they melted them once. Once you've melted something, it can't be then unmelted. So these horns, you can see what the horns looked like, and the gold kind of wraps around them. In the 19th century, the horns were stolen. They made replicas of the horns because people had made drawings. These are drawings that were made of these horns. After the horns were stolen, they made replicas of the horns based on these drawings. And then later on, the replicas got stolen as well. But at that point, they managed to get them back. These material objects often have very checkered history. For our purposes, what linguists get really excited about is this little bit up here. That's what runes look like. You can see this horrible nonsense that I showed you on the previous slide. These are runes. And as I've said, they're a thing of great beauty. As you can see down here, the runes were carved around the top end of the horn, around the end that's furthest from the mouth. So this is a runic item. This is one of the early items that suggests that one of the very earliest pieces of concrete evidence for the Germanic languages. Here is something moving forward in time. Here we've got something called the Frank's casket, which is a piece of writing, an item that you can actually go and see. That's wrong. It's in the British Museum, not the British Library. It's a really beautiful piece of art. But what gets linguists excited is the runes, because the runes run all the way around it, they actually means something. For now you can take my word on this, these runes up here, that's an R, then you've got an O rune here, and an M, and then a w, a, l, a, s. So this spells out Romwallis. And then if you know a little bit about mythology, you can see what this story is getting at. Because here you've got a wolf, you've got people, children being raised by wolves. So this is the story of the founding of Rome, Romulus and Remus. This is what's on the Frank's casket. But this is what our runic material looks like. This is one of our richest pieces of runic evidence. By this point, this is Old English runes. So Old English runes are a little bit different. The alphabet develops from the earliest Germanic runes and changes. So for instance, this rune here, this O rune, is something that you don't find in the earliest Germanic. So this is a writing system that changes, but the evidence that we have from these writing systems is not very much. When you look at these items, this is one of the most extensive things that we have. What have we got around here? A couple of sentences maximum? Doesn't really help us if we're really trying to figure out something about the Old English language. People didn't go around carving huge long stories, because carving was time consuming, it was a physically intensive job. Especially if you're carving onto something like metal or stone, you don't go around carving an entire translation of the Bible or something, unless you're completely insane. And unfortunately, no one seems to have been, at least not in that particular way. So we don't have much evidence that's written in runic. Eventually, the Old English writers started writing in a different language, in a different alphabet, the Latin alphabet, and the Latin alphabet took over. But that is something for next week, because everything today is relating to the pre-Old English phase. Pre-Old English. Well, pre-Old English covers a lot of things. As I've said, let's say Old English starts in the first half of the 5th century. And then we go back, Germanic, maybe, 1 millennium BC. We go back even further, we get to Proto-Indo-European, which was somewhere between maybe 3000 and 7000 BC. Well, that's not very far back in time. I mean, not really. We want to. What happens if we want to find out even earlier things? We know that language must have existed for many, many thousands of years before any of this. The study of the evolution of language, though it's quite controversial still, this is something that probably happened somewhere between 200,000 and 80,000 years ago. When I talk about the evolution of language, it's very important to note that what I mean is the development of the human capacity for language. So this is whatever evolutionary change happened, whatever biological change happened, that caused human beings to be capable of having language. That's what I mean by the evolution of language. Some people use the evolution of language to refer to language change in the kind of language change that we've been discussing so far today. I'm going to avoid that because I think it's deeply misleading and deeply unhelpful. So when I talk about evolution of language, which I'm pretty much only going to do on this one slide, I'm talking about the human capacity for language. Now that probably only evolved once. That is the consensus. It's not necessarily the case, but probably this only evolved once. It evolved in Africa when all of the people, all of the humans, were there. In this timescale that I've just mentioned, so probably between 200,000 and 80,000 years ago. Certainly, it has to have happened before the dispersal of modern humans from Africa. What's really a little bit unclear is how much before that it actually happened. So there's currently a debate about whether the Neanderthals, who are related to Homo sapiens but not the ancestors of Homo sapiens, whether they also had language or not, whether they had something that can be called language or not. That's a very hotly debated question. This whole field has a lot of very hotly debated questions. Some of it is quite speculative. There are modern methods that start to shed light on this kind of question in a more interesting way, but it still remains a little bit of a minefield. Yeah. Oh, sorry, I thought you had your hand up. Are there any questions? Good, because I don't know much about this. read about it. There are books. Okay, but so we've got a gap. We've got a gap of at least probably 80,000 years. So 80,000 years ago, language evolved, at least. And the earliest records that we have are from about 7,000 years ago. And the furthest we can go back using the comparative method is maybe about 6,000 years before that, maximum, depending on how good the records are. But that's because it's because the comparative method relies on regular sound change. It relies on being able to set up these systematic correspondences that I've showed you. So, for instance, German Haus versus Swedish Hus, all of these Grimm's Law, the changes that we talked about in the first part of the lecture. So that's what the comparative method relies upon. But this kind of, the more time passes, the more this kind of change can get obscured. So for instance, words can be borrowed from other languages. The borrowing of words, usually words replace existing words, and at that point, you've got a problem because the existing word was evidence from an earlier sound change that we now no longer have. So when words get borrowed, older words get lost. Words also change in meaning, and they change meaning in ways that can be quite hard to predict. So that also makes it much harder to set up regular sound changes. So we saw earlier on that, for instance, English tide is cognate with German Zeit. So the tide, which is something that the sea does, it goes out and it goes in, and a Zeit, which is a time, those words are cognate, but there has been a semantic change in at least one of English and German. Now you can kind of see how the words, how the meanings time and tide might be related. Right? It's to do with regularity, it's to do with the moon and the measurement of time. But semantic change can be quite difficult to predict in this way. And it's not always as straightforward as that. And the longer we leave it, the more semantic change there will be. So all this stuff piles up. We get further regular sound changes happening, you get borrowings, you get semantic shifts, and all of this stuff makes it harder and harder to establish systematic correspondences. So if you go further and further back in time, your results get more and more speculative. And that's why people usually say that we can't go any further back than Indo-European using the comparative method. We can maybe hypothesize that Indo-European was related to these other languages, to other languages maybe, but we don't really have any concrete evidence for that that's reliable and robust because we're dealing with such a great time depth that we don't that we can't be confident. And so that's the usual assumption. If we go further than 6,000 years back from our records, the results just become no better than noise. So that still leaves us with a big gap. Now, people have tried to get around this. People have tried to get around it by saying, for instance, let's give up on the comparative method. If the comparative method, you know, this method of establishing systematic sound correspondences, if it doesn't work, then we need to use a different method. And one method that people have used is called mass comparison or multilateral comparison. This is associated with linguists like Joseph Greenberg and Merritt Rulin. Basically what you do is you look at loads of words in loads of different languages and you look for similarities between them on the basis that if you get enough data, you will eventually end up with results that tell you something, even if you can't establish, or you're not able to establish, or you don't want to establish systematic correspondences. Now, this method leads to some unreliable results, as has been demonstrated. We can see why. Because mass comparison won't allow you to distinguish, for instance, borrowing from systematic sound correspondences. It won't allow you to distinguish onomatopoeia. It won't allow you to distinguish coincidence. But people have tried to argue for it nevertheless, and as a result, there have been some linguists who've argued that the first ever human language, proto-world, so this is the language that would have been spoken by the first evolutionarily modern humans, the ones who were coming out of Africa. This proto-world language, linguists like Greenberg and Ruhlin have tried to reconstruct this language. Now, this idea is something that most mainstream historical linguists reject. Mainstream historical linguists do not reject the idea that there was a language called proto-world, or, well, that we, there are a language that we can now call proto-world, that ended up developing into all of the world's languages. What those linguists reject is the idea that we can demonstrate this in any meaningful way. Okay, so it's a nice idea, but it's nothing more than an idea. But what's the interesting thing about this idea, and the reason that I'm mentioning it now, is that it's very, very popular in the media. So when you read, if you read magazines like New Scientist, you will see people saying things like, linguist discovers that all of the world's languages are related. And that's because magazines like New Scientist like things that are kind of controversial and a bit out there. And that's fine. But it also needs to be borne in mind that these results are usually not considered by historical linguists to be robust. An even more fine-grained things than proto-world have been criticized. So Nostratic is a proposed macro family. There's a little bit about it in the textbook. So Nostratic is somewhere between proto-world and proto-Indo-European. You can think of it as the next level up in the tree from Indo-European. It includes the Indo-European family, but also some others. So Uralic, it includes Afroasiatic, it includes Kartvelian, so the languages of the Caucasus, or some of them, Turkic, including Turkish, and more. And if this idea is right, then all of those languages are related, albeit more distantly. It's an interesting idea, and the people who've tried to establish it have mostly used the comparative method. But it's also not something like proto-world. This idea that we can demonstrate a Nostratic family is not something that's widely accepted. So if there was a family above Indo-European, it might well have been this one or something like it. But we can't know for sure. The evidence that we have is just not robust enough. And in this book by Campbell and Poser, you can see evidence, you can see a really extensive sort of examination and critique of both of these ideas, proto-world and proto-Nostratic, if you're interested. One last thing to mention before we stop, and that's kind of the elephant in the room, and that's that making claims about linguistic relatedness and reconstruction is not an ideologically neutral thing to do, or at least it often isn't the way people do it. So, for instance, the influence of Indo-European studies in the 19th century, the rise of Indo-European studies in the 19th century, has been linked fairly uncontroversially to certain ideas in philosophical romanticism, but it's also been linked to the Aryan myth, the myth of the Aryan race. This is something that it's important to remember. Indo-European studies has also been linked to Western colonialism and imperialism. So in Edward Said's work on Orientalism, he says this idea of Indo-European the reason this comparative philology was able to thrive in the way that it did was because of a sort of socio-political environment in which there was rampant colonialism and imperialism, basically. And that's important to remember. We see this now as well. So modern far-right political groups quite like to draw upon ideas from Indo-European and Germanic philology to support their worldview. And there's a little article here, if you want to read more about this and about the history of Old English studies and how it relates to questions of race, even questions of gender, this little article is quite a nice piece, quite a recent one as well. So it's important to bear that background in mind, right? I don't have an ideological axe to grind, or at least I do. Everyone has an ideological axe to grind, but at least it isn't this one, and I try to keep it out of the contentful part of it. But it's not always possible to disentangle politics from language history, and it's quite important to keep that in mind as a sort of cautionary note. Okay, are there any questions? Right, so just to recap what we've covered today, we've covered the comparative method. This is a method to establish relatedness between languages and to reconstruct unattested ancestor languages. And this works because of an important property of sound change, the property that sound change is in fact regular. English is a Germanic language that we can establish using this comparative method. We can establish also that Germanic is a branch of Indo-European, and it's defined by certain language changes, certain particular changes that set it apart from the other Indo-European languages. These are Grimm's law, a phonological change, the dental preterite, which is a grammatical change, and the shift of accent to the first syllable. Finally, anything further back in time than Indo-European gets us into controversial territory where linguists don't always agree with each other and where there is no firmly accepted truth. Your task now, should you choose to accept it, is to do exercises 1 to 4 in the textbook. If you do the exercises if you have got the older edition of the textbook, so you can tell if you've got the new edition because it says revised edition down here in the corner. If you've got the older edition, these are questions 1 and 3 to 5. But if you've got the new edition, these are exercises 1 to 4. And that's the one that you can find on Ilias. Attend the tutorial. First tutorials are this evening. Read Chapter 3 of the textbook, and next time we're going to get onto Old English itself. And that's it.